Hello and welcome to another episode of Twiml Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. This is the second show in our series of podcasts from the recent Wrangle conference. As you might know, a few weeks ago, I was in San Francisco for Wrangle, which is a great little conference brought to you by our friends over at Cloudera. Wrangle is such a fun event. Each year, it brings an interesting and diverse community of data scientists to an intimate and informal setting for great talks on real data science projects and issues, not to mention cowboy hats and barbecue. If you haven't caught the first episode in our Wrangle series, Twiml Talk number 39 with Drew Conway, you'll want to be sure to check that out. It's a great interview, and the intro includes important announcements about this series as well as our latest ticket giveaway, our online research paper discussion group, and my email newsletter. The show you're listening to now features my interview with Sharath Rao. I reached out to Sharath about being on the show and was blown away when he replied that not only had he heard about the show, but that he was a fan and an avid listener. My conversation with him digs into some of the practical lessons and patterns he's learned by building production-ready, web-scale data products based on machine learning models, including the search and recommendation systems at Instacart. A quick note before we dive in. As is the case with my other field recordings, there's a bit of unavoidable background noise in this interview. Sorry about that. And now, on to the show.
All right, everyone. I am here with Sharath Rao. He's an engineering manager at Instacart, and we are on location at the Wrangle conference. And Sharath has a talk later on, and I'm fortunate enough to have him here to tell us a little bit about what he's going to tell the Wrangle audience about. So, Sharath, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Great. Thanks for having me, Sam. I'm a big fan of the show from having heard earlier episodes.
Nice. Well, I really appreciate that. As you know, one of the places I like to get started then is to have folks introduce themselves. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to and how you got there.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm at Instacart, been here for a couple of years. Instacart is a on-demand grocery delivery service. And my role here is I started off as the data scientist or machine learning engineer focused on search, personalization, and recommendations. And now I do that, but also lead a team that is, you know, working on that effort. So prior to this, I've spent time at a couple of companies doing search, advertising, and auctions, that sort of stuff, over the last 10 years. And even going back further, grad school, I worked on speech recognition and speech translation before it was, you know, practically useful in the field. That's part of the reason why I started working on other things after grad school. So yeah, so that's probably captures the range of things.
Awesome. I hear a lot of stories from folks who, you know, I was working on this stuff in grad school and it just wasn't ready, or we were in the middle of the AI winter and it kind of went into hibernation. And, you know, now that we're all, you know, so focused on doing this stuff, it's like time to dust off those skills and
absolutely
the work.
Yeah.
So in your description, you said data science / machine learning engineering. How evolved is the distinction between the two of those at Instacart? And do you consider yourself as spanning both?
Yeah, let me take the first one first. I think at Instacart, well, overall as industry, I think we are moving better, you know, towards understanding these two roles. And so at least we are sort of settling around maybe three roles, actually: data analysts, data scientists, and data engineers. Even if they're slightly called separately, I think maybe there are companies like maybe LinkedIn or Airbnb where probably have data scientists and machine learning engineers and data engineers. Yeah. But broadly, the difference is around, you know, people working on data products, building systems and algorithms, essentially things that are consumed by other algorithms and systems who might be like machine learning engineers, people working on things, the output of which is used for, you know, decision making, you know, by the team that they serve or the executive leadership. We call them data analysts at Instacart, but data scientists elsewhere. And then finally, data engineers who are working on like platform infrastructure typically comes in, you know, maybe later in a company stage.
Right. So, I think it's a lot of progress we've made from just a few years ago when, you know, data scientist was this unicorn that no one could really hire because we've defined it in such a way that, you know, it requires these disparate skills that, you know, aren't traditionally paired.
Yeah, I remember back in maybe 2012, 2013, the term of unicorn data scientist was probably one that captures what you just described. But I don't hear that too often. Yeah. There's more like specialization, and people understand that over time, most professions end up specializing. Although I'd imagine, you know, it depends on the context of the companies. I would imagine, say, startups, if they're hiring their first data scientist, they probably want somebody who can also do like the other two things at a reasonable level of competence. Right. Overall, in a macro view, I think the roles have sort of specialized over time.
Yeah. And I remember back in that same time period, 2012, I think as a community, we thought that it would take way longer for us to reach this level of maturity. Yeah. It was like you'd see these stats that say, you know, we're going to have, you know, we're going to be under-resourced in terms of the number of data scientists until like the year 2050 or something like that. And I think this specialization has been part of the key for alleviating that stress, although we're far from having enough, you know, people with data competencies to meet all the demand.
Right.
I think every speaker at an event like this gets up and says, oh, and by the way, we're hiring.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So I've heard that, and also more recently I've heard about and maybe even seen it in the field where there's, you know, with, you know, obviously the market has responded to at least the perceived lack of, you know, strong talent. And so we have quick, like smaller one-year masters or boot camps that have served the need. So as a result, I think maybe in some part of the market, they might be maybe at like optimum or even oversupply of, you know, data scientists arguably at starting level.
Really? Now that's happening quickly.
Maybe, I mean, just generally that, I guess everything is moving faster. And now, even for example, with newer areas around, say, deep learning and AI, there is, you know, there are more research institutes, there are more, again, training, you know, workshops and so on, that people respond faster to needs than maybe they used to.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right, so your talk. You've got a talk in an hour.
Yeah.
What's your talk about?
Sure. So my talk is titled Lessons from Integrating Data Machine Learning Models into Data Products. Okay. So initially I had a two-part talk, but, you know, today I'm talking about like the part one of that. But really the genesis of that comes from having worked at, first of all, you know, relatively a smaller company as opposed to some of the bigger companies that wherein we have, there is a product per se, and there are machine learning models that are integrated into various parts of the product. They're making different decisions for the customers. So there's that. And then there is aspects about like data scientists building models, model prototypes, and even productionizing them, but also interfacing with product engineers within a single team. And the fact that what I call like all model prototypes look familiar, but every model in production is unique in its own way. So I'm trying to understand, try to frame a conversation about what does it mean to have a model in production? You know, what are the questions to ask yourself, and how do we communicate as data scientists with, you know, product managers and product engineers about what this model does, what are its requirements, what are the constraints? And so that's what I'll be talking about.
Okay, and so how do you structure walking people through that?
Yeah, I try to find, you know, going back to conversations within the team, for example, each time we have one team that has, you know, three or four product engineers, you know, a couple of data scientists and a designer and a PM, right? And largely most of the work happens, you know, within the team. And each time we work on an experiment or a feature that data scientists build, we have this conversation about how will this go into production. And typically the conversations, you know, if you think about it, like the process of building a model, thinking about a problem, building a model prototype, largely happens, you know, within the domain of data science, and maybe, you know, with some interaction with the PM. But the moment it goes into production, it's now touching like so many different parts of the system. And, you know, a couple of things come in, like how much time do we have to make a decision in terms of like the model, you know, running in production, you know.
Meaning if you're serving up pages live to the web, you know, you've got a certain...
Yeah, serving latency, for example. Yeah.
Address, right.
Yeah, so there's a constraint that very often gets dictated by the product itself, and rightly so. And then there's this question of, you know, for the model to be successful, how much information does it need? and how can I get that information? By information, I mean, like, for example, let's say you're trying to recommend a product. Maybe you definitely need to know if you want to, you know, it's a personalized recommendation. You need to know the user, you know, user identity and their past data. You probably need to know, like, what page they're on and so on. But do you really need to know their recent searches and, you know, recent activity? Right? That certainly is, like, short-term context. So how much context does the model need, rather, to operate successfully? Both of these sort of give you a way to think about, can I cache my recommendations? You know, what can I cache versus what needs to be served in real time? Mm-hmm. If it's real time, can I do reasonably well if, you know, let's say I'm making a decision about what product to show based on things that you've added to the cart recently. So think of a model that is continuously producing a, you know, prediction of what product is a good recommendation, but it doesn't necessarily surface that. It's always, you know, continuing to score and maintain a best estimate of a recommendation in the background. But, you know, at any point, it's available with a best effort response. So this is an example where you don't, you know, you have a good response whenever there's a need for it, but you can wait until the last moment to actually serve that recommendation. So it's things that happen in the background.
Are you describing a system that is doing, like, online learning or active learning, which is where you're updating your model kind of in place?
Well, yeah. So the model could be static. Model need not be updated, but the model predictions could be happening continuously in the background.
Based on
whatever data it sees.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got
it. It doesn't need to score and immediately report. It can keep scoring as it gets more data and then always be ready to serve a recommendation when necessary.
Okay.
Yeah. So that gives us, like, you know, so we have this, you know, four quadrant because I'm considering latency and context sensitivity of the model behavior. And we get these four quadrants where, you know, obviously you have, like, high latency is okay, but you have context sensitive and the other three possibilities.
Mm-hmm. And so is part of what you've observed, then, you know, are we at the point of maturity in thinking about this that, you know, for each of these quadrants, we've got, like, design patterns or best practices that teams, you know, either at Instacart or in the industry are following?
Certainly at Instacart, we try to place ourselves in terms of, like, where does this model sort of lie, you know, just mentally, internally. And that's sort of all, given that we've built a few experiences, few models, over the past couple of years, we have patterns. You know, we sort of know 90% of, you know, the way the model is integrated in the rest of the product when we are thinking about the model. We don't have to, like, start from scratch each time.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, search ranking, you know, we latency needs to be really low, and context sensitivity, we can start off with, you know, low context sensitivity, which means that let's say you're simply matching the search query and a bunch of products without, like, recent context. We could start there, but then the way to improve the model would be to, well, continue to have latency requirement being low, but make it more context sensitive. Obviously, it's a lot of work. That might involve a model that is re-ranking products based on, you know, recent activity. So that's one example. So with search, we start from quadrant four and go to quadrant one. Sort of will be clear from the slides, I guess. But with the recommendations, it's almost always the case that you start with, you know, start in quadrant three, wherein you cache as much as possible. You score them, you know, in batch mode. You cache them and then you serve. So that gives you, you know, you can use as much information as you want, and, you know, gives you the latitude to use more data and have, like, recommendations. The way to improve that would be to go from quadrant four to, well, quadrant three to two, I guess, where, you know, you still, you know, latency is still not a consideration. You're re-ranking your products, your, you know, candidate products, and, you know, in the background, be ready to serve. And then finally, you might have, like, contextual recommendations wherein you have to recommend something, you know, immediately, and so that becomes, like, a real-time recommendation, which is, you know, a model that, you know, re-ranks a set of products that you've cached, you know, based on the context. So the set of products you've cached may be personalized or maybe not personalized, but then when you serve, you re-rank it based on user activity and make it personalized.
Mm.
Yeah.
So how much of this machine learning engineering is machine learning and how much is engineering? Meaning a lot of what we're talking about is, you know, system level scalability, like, you know, just hardcore software engineering that, you know, in a lot of ways is orthogonal to the machine learning. Well, I guess the model stuff isn't, but in a lot of ways, it seems orthogonal. There are principles, at least, that seem orthogonal to the thing that you're scaling, right? It's web scale engineering applied to ML. So, like fine tune that statement. How much of it, you know, is specific, is domain specific, and where are those points that it gets super domain specific?
That's a really good question, and I think the point at which it gets domain specific is that, as a data scientist, you understand the model, its assumptions, its requirements. At what point, you know, it'll fail to perform? What does it absolutely need? What is table stakes versus, you know, what is a cherry on the top? You understand that, and you need to understand that, and then articulate it to, you know, product engineers, and to others on the team. Obviously, you don't want to do that right at the end when you've already built the model, but you want to do it right at the beginning so that you can know upfront if there are any constraints on the engineering side.
Right.
So it is sort of a good mix of machine learning, you know, and software engineering, and even product design, frankly. You know, I'd imagine one of the things we found, for example, is we may have some latitude in how we change the product experience for a user based on some of the constraints on the engineering and machine learning side. For example, if you want to buy yourself time to be able to score, what would that interface, what will we do with the customer at that time? How do we design the product experience?
Interesting. I've talked to a few people about this. Like, I think there's an evolving field of, like, I always call it intelligent design, but that's like way overloaded. But there needs to be, and I think there will be, you know, some, you know, thought best practices, for lack of a better term, like a way of thinking about designing kind of in light of machine learning and intelligence and things like that, that, you know, I don't see a lot of people talking about that kind of stuff yet. And it's not necessarily exactly what you're describing here. What you're describing is, even, you know, kind of going back to the previous question, it's really more the interaction between, you know, design and product engineering and, like, performance engineering and things like that. Like, how does a user experience change because of the limitations, you know, in, you know, performance and product engineering and stuff like that?
Yeah. I definitely think it's definitely controversial to suggest that we have to change user experiences to work with the limitations of, you know, engineering or machine learning, right? And it may not be common to do that, but I wish I had, like, more examples where it's possible to do. Maybe it's not something that we generally talk about, if indeed it happens in the field. And that's the other thing, which is, like, it's hard to talk, like, about machine learning models in production widely, simply because there are a lot of details that are probably very specific to the product, and, you know, one just assumes that it's not interesting to somebody else, or that these details don't really generalize. So there are definitely basic principles, you know, of software engineering, but beyond that, are there other principles that are specific or that are more important when it comes to, like, software engineering with, like, machine learning systems or data products? So I called out a couple of examples of some work in the community, like recently, maybe about early this year, there was a document from one of the machine learning engineers at Google about, I think it's called Rules of Machine Learning or so. It talks about a really nice, what I think is a required reading for data scientists building data products, about what are the different things, what are the different trade-offs, what are the different stages of building a data product, and talks a lot about the engineering aspects, the training, the data management, metrics, the interface between, like, metrics and model formulations and so on. It's kind of like, you know, it's a 4-page PDF with such density of knowledge. Like, at Instacart, we had, like, a reading group session. I led a group with, like, 2 hours of going through that and talking through, like, salient ideas from that paper.
Okay. Well, I have to make sure I get a link for that one and post it up in the show notes.
Definitely, yeah. There's one more paper that I like quickly, which from Pinterest, where they talk about the evolution of the recommendation systems over 3 years. And it's a really good one, I think. It talks about how they started off with a simple system that was like caching recommendations, sort of the quadrant 3 world. And then from the how they progress from that to, you know, quadrant 1, wherein they use what you get, what you cache, and then you re-rank it with a model. It's helpful to have this, you know, view of how this really massive, you know, at scale recommendation system evolved, so that, you know, people who haven't done that before don't need to believe that we need to start with what Pinterest has in production after 3 years of work.
Right.
So it's sort of underappreciated part of literature, I think.
Yeah. Well, this is maybe a little bit of a tangent, but I don't know if you've heard on some recent podcasts I've mentioned that I'm going to be starting an online paper reading group of podcast listeners. I mentioned it randomly in a podcast, and there were a bunch of people who expressed interest in it. So I'm going to be getting that kicked off. But since you mentioned that you are involved in one at Instacart, any tips for running a paper reading group?
Great. So yeah, let me see. We have two different sessions where all the data scientists come together.
Okay.
Sort of alternate weeks. And one of them is, or the one that I was talking about, we call that lunch and learn. We do it over lunch every Tuesday. And the bar, in a sense, is that, ahead of time, we talk about what paper somebody's going to lead a discussion.
Right.
That person doesn't need to have completely understood, but it's helpful for them to be able to know enough to drive the discussion. It's obviously optional for people who want to attend, because there are we touch different domains in Instacart, so somebody may not be particularly keen on a paper, right? But then it helps to have discussion. If you come in, make sure you've skimmed the paper and come in for discussion. We talk about what the paper, some of the what are the takeaways from the paper, and also how that immediately might apply to what we're working on, in our regular work.
How long do they tend to run?
It's a 1 hour, and we typically have anything from 8 to 12 people in that, group.
Okay.
I would say maybe 4 to 5 of them will have looked at the paper a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think these are opportunities for people to not just learn, but also lead a discussion.
Right.
And people get better at it as they go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm really looking forward to it. And like I said, a lot of other people seem to be looking forward to it as well. So I'd love to have you join us and walk us through a paper of your choice.
Really? Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's very common in grad school and research labs to be doing this. Reading the paper is an art, and understanding what is the next, what are the assumptions, what do they achieve, what are the opportunities from here, how can we build on that, what is relevant to us,
right?
How hard is it to reproduce, in our environment, right? That, what are the generalizable lessons, so to speak?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Those are sort of the questions we are thinking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So kind of going back to your presentation, what are the generalizable lessons from your presentation?
Sure. So one of them is to think deeply about how the model integrates into your product. Have that discussion ahead of time with people outside, your own group, of data scientists, maybe, product managers, product engineers. The kickoff meeting should probably talk about that.
And at what level are you having that conversation? Because there's integration from the perspective of data, there's integration from the perspective of data sources, APIs.
Yeah, generally at the level of APIs.
Okay.
And it's also a way to sort of get a buy-in from product engineers, build that relationship so that things shouldn't look like you're just throwing things over the fence to the engineer and asking them to productionize it. I think for them to understand it in a way that is at a level that they can even provide an input to and contribute to improve the design, the technical implementation would be helpful. And I picked out two different aspects of latency and context sensitivity. There might be others. I picked up two, and I got a 4-quadrant hub. Yeah, we can look at more aspects of it that are generalizable across models. And I hope it sort of evolves into a discussion about how we can, we have ways to talk about model prototypes, how a problem is set up and how training data is generated, at some point, the model is fit and we persist the model. We have, abstractions about what happens, in training phases, but abstractions that help us understand how a model is, being served, how the model predictions are being served, and how it's actually executed and implemented might be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I keep coming back to this idea of design patterns.
Yeah.
You may be familiar with the Gang of Four design patterns book, where there's, they've cataloged, I don't remember the year, but, cataloged a lot of object-oriented design principles. Are we there yet with machine learning, or?
Great question. I think I probably had I tweeted this question a few, maybe a year ago.
Oh,
what
yeah?
sort of, abstractions do we have for, you know, serving machine learning models in production?
Right.
I don't know of any that is that substantially builds on, like, you know, software engineering patterns, like, or I don't know of anything that the community has agreed on. I'm sure there are a lot of things that in people's heads.
Yeah.
And a little bit of that I'm talking about today will be about, like, what I, you know, have seen and working in our team. But going back to the Google Doc, I think that, again, although it talks about more than just serving, I think we need more of that in the community. Yeah. To imagine that there isn't enough generalizable because things are just too coupled with the product is probably not true.
Yeah, you made an interesting comment early in the conversation about how you have a lot of these machine learning models in production, but they, you know, at some level, they all seem like snowflakes, I guess is what I took from that. And that, you know, it's been an effort and a challenge to kind of extract the general principles from across these different environments. Is that kind of what you were getting at?
Yeah, insofar as we're talking about, like, implementation.
Yes. Right, yeah, right.
They're solving different problems, but there might be, like, in terms of, like, software engineering patterns, they share, like, some of these aspects that they're either in one of these quadrants.
Yeah. Are there common implementation / architectural patterns that, you know, that are kind of assumptions for you guys that, you know, you're doing across all, at least all new efforts? Like, for example, microservices. Are you doing microservices? Containers? Are you doing containers? Like, does any of that, where does the kind of evolution of the state of the art in, you know, software engineering for non-ML stuff intersect with ML stuff?
Good question. And, well, to your earlier point, yeah, we have services that are, well, we can call them microservices, I guess, but yeah, we have, you know, engineers, well, product engineers and machine learning engineers agree on, you know, certain contracts. And so that is like table stakes. There are questions about, like, what can we cache, what can we not cache. There are questions about, well, yeah, how long can we cache something, you know, what sort of data stores we might use, and what is configurable, what is not, what is, yeah, what is an experiment versus what is not. Most things are experiments. How much do we expect to iterate on this feature before, you know, we think we're done for a while?
Yeah.
Which is, I think, for a company like Instacart, where there are a lot of different places we can invest in. It might be like quite a few months before we come back to, you know, V2 of something that we built.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're still exploring the space of areas where machine learning can help and, you know, where help the most, I guess. Yeah. But to your point about, like, beyond software engineering, what is new? Yeah, I don't think I have an answer right now.
Okay, yeah. Okay. To follow up on your last comment on just the opportunity prioritization, at Instacart, are you generally taking an approach of, like, trying to take on, you know, big moonshot types of problems and, you know, make a few small big bets to kind of, you know, ensure that your resources are focused on, you know, these things that could have outsized impact? Or is it more, you know, we're going to try to touch, you know, broadly, you know, in, you know, high impact but more concentrated ways to kind of spread that impact around the, you know, the systems and the various business teams and processes?
Yeah, I think there's probably there's a top down and bottom up in terms of what sort of projects get worked on and explored. You know, within say data science, for just to stay in data science for a moment. So we have company goals about, like, what are we, you know, quarterly goals, long-term goals, the translate to company goals, which typically talk, you know, are aligned to some metrics, and, you know, different teams should know how they can move certain metrics. And, you know, there is, and then we think about, like, what sort of a data science effort could serve that metric. So there's that. What I call the bottom up is, well, you know, in the end, we are e-commerce, but also last mile, you know, logistics operation. So naturally with that domain, some problems just are there. Like, if you have e-commerce operation, you have a search engine. If you have a search engine, you're probably working on, like, you know, spell correction and autocomplete and, you know, search ranking, matching, basically understanding the queries better, and recommendation systems and so on. So we already know, given the kind of data we have we collect what sort of problems have been addressed, like what sort of product features have been useful in that sense. So between the top down and bottom up, I think we generally find, you know, tactically projects to work on, you know, given, you know, current goals. Yeah. And oftentimes, you know, we hit like diminishing utilities soon enough, or plateau soon enough, maybe in the first version, and we might wait for like a while before we come back to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I think you've got a presentation to get ready for, but I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us, and I'm looking forward to your talk.
Sure. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Shar.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening and for your continued support of this podcast. For the notes for this episode, to ask any questions, or to let us know how you like the show, leave a comment on the show notes page at twimlai.com/talk/39. Thanks again to our sponsor for the Wrangle Conference series, Cloudera. To learn more about Cloudera and the company's data science workbench family of products, visit them at cloudera.com. And be sure to let them know how much you appreciate their support of the podcast by tweeting to them at @cloudera. If you're interested in joining our first TwiML online meetup, where we'll discuss Apple's recent research paper on generative adversarial networks, you can register for that at twimlai.com/meetup. And don't forget to sign up for our email newsletter at twimlai.com/newsletter. Thanks again for listening, and catch you next time.